Okay, so reimagining Christian higher education. We're going to actually start with three questions that we're going to move through during our time here. First one is, why do we really even need to reimagine Christian higher education? I think that we all know that there are a lot of threats hitting us, but let's think together about what those threats are and how it's going to reshape us, what keeps us from doing this, and what would it look like to reimagine the enterprise. So let's start. Now, I have to tell you that the first part of this presentation is going to feel a little like this, okay? And I really actually don't know a president in higher education right now that can't relate to this picture, right? I mean, it feels like we are running as fast as we can, and this bull is coming after us, and we're trying to get out of the way, we're trying to get on the fence, we're trying to outrun it, but it does feel that way. But I want to say hang in there, because we will get to a point where we start throwing out some ideas and some ways to think about how we could reimagine the enterprise. So I want to talk to you about four, and there really are six, two technology I'll cover tomorrow, but there are really four things that are shifting underneath the American landscape that dramatically affect what we do in higher education. But oftentimes in higher ed, we work in this kind of cloistered way, and we don't really, really understand the impact that what is happening in America is actually happening, is really impacting what we do. So I just want to cover these four pretty quickly, going to move fast. I will tell you that they're going to put these slides up on the G Drive for everyone to access. So don't feel like you need to write anything down. Unless I say something really amazing, and then you'll want to write that down and give it to me, because I don't say too many amazing things. So, all right, so let's start with wealth distribution. I mean, we all know this. Rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer in America. We look at this and we say, what's happened to us over the last 30 years? From 1980, the blue line is the bottom part of the U.S. The axis is shared national income. So over these last 30 years, the bottom 50% has lost an incredible amount of the shared national income, where the top 1% has gained that. It's been an interesting shift that kind of crossed over in about 1995. You also begin to really understand that wealth distribution in America really does follow racial lines. And when you look at Hispanic and black households, they've stayed very even in terms of their net wealth across the years. You also find that I think it's not just the wealth distribution, it is the fact that I think the middle class feels like they are getting behind, and they are. When you look at the GDP growth, corporate taxes, the 1% income, you see that the middle income is just not moving forward like everyone else is. So when people start really grimacing and talking about the cost of higher education, you know, and how expensive it is, actually, higher education, here's the secret, right? It's always been expensive, okay? It's the fact that the middle class is shrinking, and that's who we bring into our institutions, and their earning power is going down. That's where we begin to see the real tension on the cost of higher education. The second tension that we find is that the more we have a bottom class, the lower quartile, the more children we have in poverty, right? And this is bad just because of children in poverty, right? But its impact on higher education is more stunning than you would think, okay? So, you know, 43% of our children are near poverty or living in poverty. And if you look at it, again, you unpack the data and you find that it runs in some very different lines. So for folks who are Asian, only 29%, white, about 30%, Hispanic, 61%, American Indian, and black. So the amount of kids that live in poverty really does go along racial lines to a certain degree. And it also goes along state lines. So we find that more children, a significantly more amount of children in the southern states, are living in poverty. I guess it's because that, you know, who wants to move to the cold weather if you're poor too? That's just adding insult to injury. So they live in the southern states historically. But the problem is not just that we have poor students, but it's that what it does to our poor students. And those poor students are still coming to college. They're still walking in the front door of our institutions. But they have had inadequate nutrition, which has changed their brain development. They've had fewer learning experiences. You know, low-income students don't have computers in their home. They don't go to enrichment courses. They don't take classes during the summer at the museum. They don't have that kind of access to those activities. The school districts they come from, You know, many of them do well to graduate. 63% of their, 30 to 40% of their students don't even make it out the front door when they leave. Dangerous streets, less access. So as we think about more and more kids getting moved into that low poverty range, we also need to understand that when they walk through our door, what they bring to them is very, very different than what our middle class students have been bringing over all these years. But you say, wait a minute, isn't college the great equalizer? And I will say that college is still the best bet in America. It is still a great enterprise. But the fact of the matter is, it's a great enterprise for certain groups of people in America, and it's a so-so enterprise for the rest of the groups, right? So here's high school graduation rates. And we actually have been making some improvement in our lower, these are your quartiles, your income quartiles, right? So you can see our lower income quartile has made some improvement in access. All boats have risen. But the problem is, when they get to college, they graduate, they get to college. This is when the great bifurcation happens, actually, right? These are low income kids who graduate in 6 years. Who graduate by 24, right? If you're in the low-income grouping, only 11% of you will graduate from college in 6 years by 24. Only 11% enter the front door. Mm-hmm. 58%, which is still egregious to me, that the high-income, still half of them are leaving, not half, but 58%, 42% are still leaving our institutions. But look at the gap. And that gap is in our lap, you know. If you look at your retention numbers, like many campuses, yours may be a little different, but you will see that you lose a fair amount, a large amount, from your lower income groups. Financial aid, the stresses, all the different kind of things that they do. But we're creating part of the issue in America, and we need to really look that straight in the face and say, what can we do? But here's the real problem that gets me working in higher ed, is that this is the rate of tuition and fees, right, for public and for private, how they've gone up. And this is the criticism we get in the press that our rates have gone up. Here's what we actually bring in net tuition revenue, right? This is the killer. Because everybody thinks we're doing this, but this is what we're really bringing in. It's this gap. You know, it's the financial aid arms race that we've gotten into. It's the increasing discount rate that we've gotten into. But it is also the divestment of the government in higher education. And we don't talk about that enough, right? But at the state level and at the national level, we've seen a divestment. So what happens when they divest? We have to make up this difference to allow our students to come. And for low-income students, it's even more problematic. Look at this. This is the Pell Grant. So these are our lowest-income students. Everything has gone up except the Pell Grant, percentage-wise, right? And if you look up here, this is even more graphic. This shows you the increase of college, and this is the Pell increases. Now, this is 12, and we have made a little bit of difference, which you can see over here in 16-17. We haven't made that much difference, right? We're just not keeping up for our low-income students, so it means what happens? The colleges and the universities have to make the difference, and thus we get this net tuition gap between as we go forward. I was laughing. I was at Zion National Park not too long ago, and I was taking the shuttle back, and I was late getting out, and there's only one other guy on the shuttle. And he starts talking to the bus driver. He has a kid that's going to college. He starts talking to the bus driver about, you know, how expensive these higher education bureaucrats and all these, you know, blah, 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 blah. Well, I'm sitting there, and I'm like, just ignore it. Just drink your water, try to stay hydrated. But I couldn't, right? I had to get up. I moved seats, and I said, let me tell you what's really happening, right? It's really your government that's divesting of education during the time when education should be more and more and more valuable given where we need to go economically. So anyway, so be careful if you sit next to me at anything. You never know what you're going to get. But it's not just the cost of tuition that's getting us. It's the student loan debt, isn't it? This is medium debt. But I always say, you guys, it's not just the debt load, right? It is the wages aren't going up. So we used to be able to have, we've always had debt in higher ed. Now it's a higher percentage, but the real tension is that these wages aren't going up in a way that allow us to pay this back in a reasonable point of time. Right? So you have a social work degree and you graduate from the university and you've got $40,000, $50,000 in debt. it's going to take you years. In fact, completely change when you're going to be able to own a home because your debt ratio is going to be too high for your mortgage. And so these are the things that, you know, we really have to worry about. And then this is one of the, there are many slides in here that my faculty colleagues don't appreciate me putting up, but this is percent of recent graduates who are underemployed. Because underemployment is a huge problem for us. 43% overall of our students that graduate in the first year, first 12 months out, are underemployed. It's the whole, ha, 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 I'm working at Starbucks until I figure it out. I'm like, you just spent $120,000 to figure it out. Now you're going to spend 6 more months working at Starbucks, right? That, you know, something's not happening right for us. But if you look at some of these degrees, like criminal justice, which is one of the faster-growing degrees in America, 75% get out and they're underemployed. The reason being is that many of them go into police forces. And in a police force, you don't have to have a bachelor's degree to be a policeman. So they consider that underemployed. So you can see all the way down the ranking. And what the new research has really come out and is showing is your first job sets you on a path. So if you are considerably underemployed, in the next 5 years, so 2/3 of those graduates who are 4 in 10 are underemployed, 2/3 of those will still be underemployed 5 years later, and 3/4 of that 2/3 will still be unemployed 10 years later. So you can see that getting out of being underemployed is not as easy as you would think. It's not as easy as just leaving your job at Starbucks, but you get tracked into some different levels that we have to really, really take seriously. And so I know we oftentimes think of education or higher education as between the freshman and the senior year, but what I'm starting to really talk to people about is I think we have a responsibility beyond the senior year, and part of the fact that we haven't stepped up to the plate and taken that responsibility is part of the criticism that we're getting is you got this expensive degree and you don't have a job. All right. Declining birth rates. This is my new tangent. But here is decline in students attending college, okay? So a lot of times when people say college attendance is in decline by, you know, 15 or 20%, it's because of the for-profit colleges. If you take them out of there, it's not in decline like the press would like us to think. But four-year private nonprofit, you can see we are just scratching along, right? Like our last really good year was here. In the fall of 2014, we had another little bump. But for most of us on our campuses, when I talk to people, there are maybe one or two or three private faith-based institutions that seem to really be in a growth mode. But the rest of us are just holding on. And I kind of laugh because working at Azusa, you know, down the street from us is Biola. And I always said, when our enrollment was up, theirs was down. And when theirs was up, ours were down. We're all going after the same pool of people. And so when it's up and down and it's those kind of things. But it is a very, very hard road right now, as we all know and feel that tension for traditional undergrad students. But what you see and what concerns me more than anything is the decline in the birth rate. Okay, so where we began to see it really is 2006 and 7, when the economic downturn happened, the birth rate began to really take a downward plunge. Now, what happens in economic downturns is you usually have a 5-year birth rate decline, and then it starts picking back up in a pretty robust way. We are not seeing the uptick. Okay, and that's really what has the economist and those types of people concerned, because when this goes down, you know, eventually these folks will retire, and it will be such a small generation that they won't, during their earning potential, they won't be able to fund Social Security for a very large generation that's coming through. But if you look at that, these 18 to 24 year olds begin to hit us about 2025. Now I know some of you are thinking, okay, I'm going to get off the board about 2022, and that'll be somebody else's problem, right? I mean, I would be thinking that, right? A lot of the presidents in the room are thinking that same thing. Okay, got about 5 more years. I'm going to take the road. But the reality about 2025 is that it really is very, very soon. In higher education terms, it's like next door. this is a year that we should all put on our doors and begin to say, what are we going to do differently to position us so in 2025 we're not one of the many universities that will start to go out of business, all right? But what's fascinating about it is that that's not all bad news in a way, because one of the big things that's led the decline is the birth rates for 15 to 19-year-olds have been in a pretty significant decline. So it is also something about this generation is, for whatever reason, is having less children. But it is also the millennials. The millennials are not having children. And everybody keeps thinking it's going to be a delayed, you know, that they're going to have. And we have seen an uptake in birth from 35 to 42. So older women, there has been an uptake, but certainly not at all like the decline that we're having in the other areas. So they're not able to balance that out. And even though we thought that this would really jump to make up for the lack of childbirth earlier, it hasn't. It hasn't jumped. There's an uptick, but the decline is still there. So, and I'm afraid in our current American status and our current political, that for some millennials, it's not a good time to have a child. They don't feel like it's a good time to have a child. So, but what's interesting is that it's an uneven picture, isn't it? So this is the forecasted growth in high school graduates. The blue is 7.5, an increase of 7.5, and the red is a decrease of 15%. So you can see that if you're in Texas, you're golden, okay? But as someone who lives in Texas part of the year, you realize everybody and their mother's dog is going after Texans right now. I mean, you know, the advertising in Texas for other universities is kind of interesting. So even though they have a high school graduation rate that's going to be higher and more robust than a lot of our schools. Now, these you have to take into, you know, because this is percentage. And, you know, in this school, if they, you know, if they graduate 30 more students, that gives them 7.5, right? I mean, they only have 6,000. South Dakota only graduated 2,000 students this year. So, you know, so put it into perspective when you get up here. Down here, it's robust and the Florida and those kind of things. But it's not equal, even in its robustness, right? So if you look at, this is white, non-Hispanic. There are very few dark blue spaces. I mean, here's the thing we know and we've been talking about, right, is that we are not going to be able to have our schools that are as white and middle class as they've been before because the market is just not there. The kids are just not there, right? The kids are Hispanic and Asian. They really are. And we talk about it, and I think we all know it, and we kind of acknowledge it, but I'm not sure we understand really how much this changes the world or how much it should change the world as we go forward. And then this is the forecasted growth in college going, right? So these were high school graduates, and these are college going, which is a whole nother picture because you can have high school graduates and they don't go to college. And again, Texas still looks pretty good, but if you see, it's these urban areas. That's what the circles are, is the urban areas. So then you compare it to the high school graduates, and you see, you know, it's a different cluster. But the reality of it is that in the Northeast, this is a hard road, isn't it, for Houghton and other places. This is a hard road to hoe, and it's going to take a complete revamping of higher education if we're going to be here in 5 and 10 years, because you just can't keep doing the same thing and expect high school students to come. I don't care how great your marketing and how great your enrollment group is, those kids don't exist anymore. So where are we going to go to get them? And then this is the forecasted growth in students who attend regional. So you'll see, the point I wanted to make here is the elites, the Ivies, the four-year private national, they're not going to feel this decline in birth rate. They will not feel it one bit. Stanford will still be as selective as it always is. Even the national four-year, you're going to feel it, but not quite as much. It's us, regional 4 years, that we're going to have an inordinate amount of impact with this decline in birth rate. I know. It makes you happy to be here, doesn't it? Like, you're like, I'm going to the pool. Well, take a break. I'm going to the pool. But where we have seen the enrollment growth and where the enrollment growth is still projected is in online. I love this quote. The growth of distance enrollments have been relentless. They have gone up when the economy was expanding and when the economy was shrinking and when overall enrollments were growing and now when overall enrollments are shrinking. For some reason, they've had a resilience that most sectors in higher education don't experience. But, and so you begin to see, you know, the all institutions, the private, for-profit, only 75% of our students now are the traditional students that we think of, and 16.5, and for some schools, I'm sure like IWU and other places, it's a really different kind of pie chart. This is national data. But here is the reality of this, you guys, is that it is getting so much more competitive in the online space. I mean, if you don't have online now, I still think you're going to have to think about some kind of different distribution system to your education, but you're going to have to think very differently about partnerships. I think the market of just putting up your shingle, making sure you have enough Google ads, having a few good classes online, and you're good, those days are over. Right? They're over. Because these big organizations, big universities, 10 of the largest institutions, 10 of the largest online institutions have a fourth of the students going there. And the latest numbers are even higher than that. Okay, so you find that even though Phoenix has taken a huge backward hit, they're still large, right? I mean, 100,000 students is still large. They 3 years ago, graduated as many students as all Christian colleges put together. Right? So just to give you some kind of context. Western Governors, Southern New Hampshire, Arizona State, even little Maryville. Maryville got a $2 million grant to launch and to market their education, I mean their online education. So that's why you see them on ESPN ads and all over the place, because they have gone all in marketing in a national model. Most of us can't afford that, can we? I mean, most of us, that's completely out of reach for us. And so it's going to be much more difficult to grow online as it's ever been before. And I want to talk about that a little bit more later on. But then you look at the growing ideological divide. Lay that on top of it, right? On top of it. We go, the most congressional scholars would say now that Democrats and Republicans are further apart from one another than they've ever been at any point in our modern history. Okay, so we know this. This is not new. But look at some of the data. This is from the Pew Charitable, and they measure social attitudes in the population. And you will begin to see what's actually happened. Government regulation of business usually does more harm than good. This was one of the things we could kind of agree on in 2004. Look at that division now. That's a huge, for 10 years, sociologically, that's a huge change. You look at government's almost always wasteful. Look, we actually agreed on this, okay? But look at it now. All the way across. Government can't afford to do much to help the needy. 34% blue is Democrat. 73% of Republicans say we can't afford to help the needy. Blacks who can't get ahead in this country are mostly responsible for their own condition. 79% of Republicans agree with that. 50% of Democrats, which I thought was a little high. Best way to ensure peace, military. This is an interesting one for us schools, isn't it, when we're trying to deal with LGBTQ issues. Homosexuality should be discouraged by society. In both sectors, it's gone down pretty significantly for a 10-year period. I mean, obviously, we're still separated. And I don't know about you, but our students come in with some very different attitudes than we have in traditional churches, right? Like, I was talking to a student the other day, and they're like, when is your generation going to get over the homosexuality issue? I'm like, what do you mean get over it? Because for them, they're over it. I mean, that it's a done deal. Stop talking about it, right? So, which I think is a very evangelical person too. But if you would say growing divide on the impact of higher ed, percent who say colleges and universities have a positive or negative effect on the way things are going in the country. So this is the Republican data. So in 10, 58% of Republicans thought we were having a positive impact. Okay, look what happened. Yike. 36% of Republicans now think higher education is having a positive impact. Now, I think part of this depends on which news channel you listen and where you consume the news and some different things like that, because certainly some networks have been very negative on higher education. But this hurts us because we have a lot of Republican kids on our campuses, right? We have a lot of people from families that represent those kind of attitudes. And now there's this, like, I don't know, it's expensive and it's way liberal, and I don't know if I want to send my kid there anymore. It begins to really impact us. But again, the numbers are interesting. It's not all Republicans, it's not all Democrats, but you do begin to understand that the ones that are most negative about higher education are over 65, are college graduates, and make more than $75,000. But those are very influential people in America, and so it hurts us in some ways that we don't even realize. We don't even realize what our student parents are saying, because I was just talking to a friend of mine, and she's like, well, you know, Christian colleges are just getting as liberal as the rest of them. And I'm like, I don't know what Christian college you're talking about, but, you know, they're like, oh, no, you know, they're getting as liberal as the rest of them. So why should I pay that much money when I can just send them down the street to the public, you know, regional? And so that does make it a lot of angst, right, for us to really talk about our distinctive and how it plays out, because it's polarized. And it's not just the country. If it was just the country, that would be hard and bad. But it is actually, the SERP data is a survey that's run out of UCLA. It's the largest survey of institutions, incoming freshmen, and their attitudes, their social attitudes. And this, in 16, they said, this is the most polarized politically as any incoming freshman class in the last 50 years, right? So the students that are coming in our door, I was talking to a faculty colleague of mine, and he teaches in a program that they kind of thrive on some controversial topics in the classroom and getting that engagement up as people as 18 to 24 years are trying to wrestle with what they think. And he said, you know, he said, I don't know what I'm going to do this semester. He said, the last time I did it, the conversation got so polarized and so vitriolic, and nobody would listen to the other person, that it was completely counterproductive, and I just had to change the whole thing. I said, no, don't change it. Faith-based liberal arts is our best hope. Right? It is the best hope to teach people how to have these kind of civil conversations where they feel strongly about what they believe in, but they listen closely to what other people. If we don't teach them that in our colleges and universities, then who will? And how does that happen? But our campuses are becoming the battleground, and you find a lot of faculty are beginning to get more and more skittish about teaching those kind of controversial classes because of the highly emotional charge that comes with those types of things. All right. The last one, then we'll have some dialogue around the table, is the pace of learning in society. And, you know, we've moved from this agricultural to the industrial. And the industrial age was really when Research One institutions grew. It kind of became the lecture. The massification of higher education happened during the industrial age. And then we moved to the knowledge age, and you could even see it in higher education because we began to talk a lot more about, you know, not doing lectures, you know, like we used to, the sage on the stage, but getting it to be more conversational and knowledge-based and those types of things. But now we are squarely in a really new age of learning. And it's not just in colleges, it's really in America. You know, what you're finding is that so many, and I think this statistic was talked about earlier, but some people would say 40 to 70% of the jobs that we currently have could be automated with existing technologies today. Right? Now, we don't have the capital outlay to do it, but you know those kind of things are coming. The jobs that we have now for our children coming up probably will not exist in the way they do now. I was talking to a board of regents at a university, and I said, you know, one of the positions that the prognosticators will say is really ripe for upheaval is accounting. Because of the way that artificial intelligence and machine learning happens, that it is better, they're more accurate if you do it, if you run it through computers and those types of things. Well, he owned a big accounting firm, and so I think I offended him. But I said, it's not the low-level accounting, right, the H&R Block, that we still need to train our students for. It's the higher level. It's the more about the logic, and more about what goes into making tax codes and those kind of things. And I still think we're best suited for that, but I still think in higher ed we spend way too much time on the lower-level technical things that, quite frankly, they don't listen in class, and then they go Google it, and they learn it, and then they come back and take the test. So all those kind of things that they can Google and do, Why are we still teaching? I mean, it's hard, but I know why we're teaching it, because as a faculty member, that's what we're good at. That's what we've learned. That's how we teach. But it is becoming less and less relevant, that kind of thing. And you're beginning to see all sorts of intonations different kinds of higher education that are beginning to happen all across the country. And it really started 10, 15 years ago, but you just see it ramping up over and over again, is that there's less about the degree and there's more about the actual learning. What can you do? What can you really build? So let me just take a moment and see if, I don't think it's going to let me, but before we do that, I wanted to show you a video that, if I can pull it up, that Cisco did. And I always think it's interesting when business and industry creates a video about learning. Oh, that didn't work. You can listen to the music, but you can see the video. All right, so let's just go back to this. Why don't we take a few moments in, I've covered a lot of ground this afternoon, so why don't we take a few moments in our tables and talk a little bit about what struck you in the data that I talked about, and then what should we do with that? How as Regents should we begin to move on that? Okay, so what in the data that struck you the most, that you find most alarming, and what do you feel like we should begin to really focus in on, those types of things at our institutions, okay? So let's take about 10 minutes and have a conversation about that. All right, I'm bringing us back together. This is, that's the best part of the presentation right there, so I hate to break it up, but hopefully it just gets the wheels turning. Anybody have any questions or thought that they'd like to share with the room before anybody brave enough to share something that came out of the group? Yeah.
You sort of talked about kind of the whole of accreditation versus the relevance of some of the stuff. Like I shared an example my senior year at NA Wesleyan, some years ago, I needed to find some credit hours. So I took stained glass and
cool.
So it was cool. I got a great grade in it.
Yeah. Well, oh well. You know what's even more problematic than some of those one-off electives? It's changing majors. You know, I mean, changing majors can add a semester, or sometimes a year, depending on what you're changing it to. And you know, so there are. You see a movement in higher education not to let students choose majors until later on in the process, because it's a very expensive proposition when they start doing a lot of major changing, especially if the fields are fairly diverse in there. And so somebody would say, well, you can't stop them from changing majors, which is true. It's a free country. But can't we do something? I mean, isn't there something else that we can think about and do and all those kind of things. So I think there are a lot of really hard questions like that. I mean, you graduate. My nephew went to Baylor, and he graduated with because he wasn't ready to start, and so he flunked out. And my niece started that year too, and she transferred to A&M to be with her boyfriend. And I was in charge of retention, and we got the list of all the kids that had left. And my staff said, if my family would stop coming to Baylor, we could improve retention like overnight. So he wasn't ready to start. He wasted all that money, left with $60,000. He is computer information scientist. He paid off that debt in 4 years, right? Because he makes $140,000 5 years out of Baylor, right? He can do that. But the social work major, they ain't ever going to make $140,000, right? But yet we charge the same tuition, and they have the same kind of indebtedness. And so there are a lot of ethical struggles right now in higher education when it comes to those kind of questions. What's fair? So I'm going to just end this presentation for the next 15 or 20 minutes. And I always believe the fact is that we need to really ask more questions about what we're doing and think, you know, really challenge the assumptions that undergird a lot of higher education. So I'm just going to begin with a few of the questions and throw out some ideas and some thoughts and get conversation going that way. So, you know, my big question is, can we really conceptualize our institution as being for learning across the lifespan? So if you think about it right now, most of us still, even when we have adult online programs, the traditional undergraduate experience is still the center of the world on most of our campuses, right? But what's happened to us is that because it is, we've taken our adult programs and we've kind of seen them as cash cows, right? And we've been pulling resources from them to fund this enterprise, which is okay and not okay in the sense that then this enterprise costs us more than it makes because we're going to rely on this. But when this begins to really, for this to grow, this is going to need a new infusion of cash itself, right? So it begins to really ask yourself those hard questions about, can we continue to have this kind of model for our adult online programs? Because it stunts their growth. It stunts their ability to recreate themselves and to market themselves. But yet, for most of us, we got into this so that we could do this, right? And so the question, I think, for a lot of universities right now is, can we afford to still do that? Is that what we want to do? Especially in a time when we're talking about learning across the lifespan. So mostly what we do in higher education is we do predominantly bachelor's degrees, master's and doctoral, and then some of us have early programs in the high school. This is predominantly what we do. But I think the question for us is, can we think differently about this? Can we think about higher education over the lifespan in some ways that are really, because the fact of the matter is, we are getting older and older, right? And our lifespan is elongating to the point where I think, you know, at some point it's going to break Social Security, but it's great for people like me who are getting older, right? But it's going to. So why do we think of higher education still as just this? This is our business, right? This is our business. And learning now has to happen constantly. It has to not be something, this idea that you can get a degree at 21 and that degree is still going to make sense to you at 52 is ridiculous, right? And so we have to think about, you know, second career preparations and how we do that differently. I have a couple of friends who have homeschooled their kids and stay-at-home moms, and they just launched all their kids to college this last year. And so now they're like, what do I do? Like, what's my career now? You know, I want to go back to college, but what's the place for me? And how do I figure those kind of things out? And I think because if we live longer, this is going to be a career break. And we're going to begin to reconceptualize and rethink. So why don't we get ahead of that? And why don't we really build programs that lengthen out what we do and how we think about it? Why we've got to get away from this model of credit hours, you know, 15 weeks, you know, all those kind of things. It's not how learning happens, and it's not how it's going to happen in the future. Find ways to fund, different ways to fund higher education. Seriously consider this thought, because really, all of us pretty much are in the tuition-dependent road. Not if you're an elite, you can be endowment-driven, but we've got tuition, we've got endowment income, we've got fundraising, we've got grants and federal money, right? And that's pretty much it. That's pretty much the limit of our ability. Well, what if we really started thinking about the cost in some different ways? Huntington University has started a new thing called HU Ventures. They're working with Amazon, and they're creating a business around distribution, those types of things. That business reports to a foundation because unfair business, all sorts of different kind of things. They report to a foundation. But then that foundation, any profit they make, they turn that money back into scholarships for the kids that are in that program. So basically, it's what we think about in terms of a work college, where you work off your tuition. They do that. We need more models like that. Right? We need more businesses and industries. We're beginning one at Warner in the fall around digital design and marketing. So we're taking one of the old houses on campus, we're gutting it, we're making it into a really cool digital firm. The students work in it for 3 years. The first year, it's all about sales, consumer behavior, those types of things. The second year is about product development. And the third year is about managing it, the finances, the ROI, looking over the... And then the fourth year, we want them to go out into internships in the world. But in those 3 years, they are running that business as a part of their coursework, right? Because when you get to be 18 and you start talking about ROI and customer behavior, you don't have any hook. You don't have any experience to learn that and to think about that. But if you have this, and who we're appealing to are churches, nonprofits who can't afford the high-end social media firms, but they can come here, have our students develop for them their social media strategy. We get the money, we pour it back in. Those kind of the ideas, I mean, it probably might not work at your campus, but what are the new ideas? Why are we still so just based in tuition? I think a lot of schools are beginning to really take seriously the three-year model, a three-year degree program. Most of them will have a three-year track or a four-year track. Because if you think about it, if you cut off a year from a student's, it's not just the tuition, because they'll probably still pay about the same amount of tuition. It's actually the earning potential. They will be in the workforce a year earlier. So if they make $45,000 that year, you have turned to them $45,000. Most of the schools, most of the colleges and universities in Europe are three-year programs, right? America, Scotland, a few others are four, but it's pretty rare. So we've kind of had a credit inflation. We spend a lot of time. When I was in college, my summers was spent as a camp counselor, right? Well, that's great if you're white and middle class and your parents and you're on athletic scholarship, right? That works because you can fund it. But so many of our lower income students, they can't afford to do that kind of activity. The summer has to be meaningful. They have to make money. So why are we still wasting our summers? Why are we sending them away? I mean, this is one my faculty colleagues really hate. You have a workforce that basically works 9 months out of the year, gets paid 12 months. You have buildings that are there for 12 months. They're only used 9 months, right? And we think that's a good business model, and we wonder why the cost of higher education is going up. Those are just the assumptions that we've made about how college runs that we have to stop and we have to begin to say, wait a minute, our low socioeconomic students need to make something different during the summer. They need to make academic progress. They need to figure this out. We need to do something different. But people think, well, students won't come during the summer. Well, they won't come during the summer for the boring, same old class they get during the school year. Okay, but they will come for something really experiential, really different, working one-on-one with faculty, labs, training, something that's dynamic. They'll come for something interesting. I've always said this. They won't come just to check off the box during the summer. And then thinking more about networked universities. There's been a lot of conversation about merging small private liberal arts. And what the early research is showing with three that have merged is that it's not a huge cost saver. It's not what you think it would be to merge. But what they found is that network universities are really where the cost savings is. And that is where we're leveraging each other. So if you're going out to bid for a food service, and you're going out with your campus that has 1,500, you get a certain bid. If you're going out with five campuses that have 8,000, you get a better bid, right? And so we have to start leveraging because we don't have scale, most of us don't. And so we've got to find ways to really do this. And I've even said in online course development, why are we individually doing that? Math is math, marketing is marketing. Now, we can add our nuances, we can add our flavors, we can add our own faith integration to those, but we could bring the cost down of new program development and speed up if we can find more consortiums to build these courses together. All right. I'm moving fast. We need to recreate our classroom environment from the ground up. Our classes need to be interesting. You walk into our classes, my classrooms at APU, and it's the same four white walls with the same tables with chairs, okay? And every class is exactly the same. And you ask students, what's your experience when you walk in this classroom? And I've asked this three or four classes, and they all said, the minute I walk in, I think boring. You know, it's just like, oh, this is what we just have to do. You know, why have our class, why have our, you know, climbing walls and things like that become the center of the world? Why haven't our classes, you know, become something that are interesting and invigorated? I always said, we know we will hit nirvana when the new student tour goes by the classroom, as opposed to just into the residence hall, right? This should be the heart of the activity where it's fun, but not in the way it is now. We need to rethink classroom space completely. I want to show you this video that is done by Stanford in their D-School of one of their classes and how they use it. Well, of course, that kind of gives you the essence of it, right? Is that, you know, all their furniture has wheels, it's movable, they move it in and out, it's the flexibility, you know, it's really required. I have to tell you, it's one story on APU, getting close to the end, but I taught leading change there, right? And so I hated the fact that my class looked like everyone else's. So I asked the physical plant guy if I could paint, or if they could paint my class with whiteboard paint all around the room, so we could write all over the walls on all the different places and all those kind of things. And the technology for whiteboard paint has gotten a lot better. You have to do priming, but it has gotten a lot better. I finally talked him into it. They were going to do it, and it got closer and closer to my class, and nothing had happened. And so I finally called him, and he said, yeah, we're sending someone over tomorrow. And I come into the class the next week. They've taken down the whiteboard, and they painted white board paint where the whiteboard is, and and put a big black tape where it was. I'm like, you know, kind of missed the point there on what we were trying to do, kind of thing. But I said, you know, I appreciate they're trying, but put the whiteboard back up. It's really bad to write on the wall when you got a whiteboard. So anyway, but it is trying to really reconceptualize these hubs of learning. And we have to challenge this lone faculty member model of course development, right? Because knowledge moves way too fast to expect one person to keep up on all of these kind of things. Classes should be built in teams. We should have one faculty member that has the historical disciplinary knowledge. But we need educational designers who can create new ways of learning. We need technology gurus. You know, you can't expect your faculty to know all of the latest bells and whistles because things move too fast, those kind of things. But they need to integrate those things into the classes. You can't get a pass anymore. We need outside experts, people that really know what's happening on the cutting edge of those areas that'll come in and help inform the curriculum and that will teach part of it with us. And we need faith integration consultants. We need the people who really understand this deeply, who can work with us, you know. When I first got to Azusa, it was my first faculty job, and I'm going to integrate faith. And I'm like, sure, I'm going to pray, you know, before class and give a devotional. Not exactly integration faith in learning, right? I mean, it's kind of Sunday school is what I did. it was good, but it was Sunday school. And so having these teams that can keep things moving and fresh and recreating them and learning, that's the model. We need different models for how we create it. And how about living on campus? I just finished at Azusa a study of 80 different universities, and we went to those universities and we asked them, tell us the most innovative things that were happening at your campus, and we went and studied them. And I tell my student life, please know, I spent 25 years in student life, VP for student life at Baylor. I bleed student life. Not one campus gave us an example of innovation in student life, right? That's painful and powerful. I think that we have to reconceptualize living on campus. We have to think differently about what that means. We need our residence halls to have maker labs in the basement so kids can go and take what they learned and make and build and experiment. We need student-run businesses on the first floor so those students that are working in the business departments can, and entrepreneurship majors and those kind of things, can run those experiments. And so the failure, if they fail in a business in the first floor of the residence halls, it's different than if they graduate, get venture capital, and fail, right? We give them places to fail and experiment. We create community rooftop gardens. We make these hubs that are alive and that are integrated into the academic mission, and students can customize. This is my, I'll tell you, I'm sure David will turn crazy. I used to always ask myself, why will we not let a student paint their room? You know? I mean, we paint our rooms. I mean, we paint our, you know, but no, we can't. Well, they may spill something. Well, then charge them, right? And if they paint it something funky and they don't paint it back, then charge them, right? And charge them for the paint. I mean, you can recoup it, and then you get to repaint your residence halls. Let them have more ownership of the residence halls, and with that, more responsibility. You know, you're going to run it. What's happened in student life in the 80s, 70s and 80s, is we began this in locus parentis, right? And we began to take over the things that they do because we didn't think they could do it as well, or maybe they didn't have the time to do it, or those kind of things. And this is what I say to anybody in student life that I'll talk. If they don't have the time to do it, they don't have time. So stop doing it for them, right? Like, we've over-proliferated the activities to try to keep people amused on campus as opposed to engaged. All right, and then what if we really thought about every student has a career coach, right, online and face-to-face, that starts with them, that stays with them, that thinks with them about their career and their calling. I should call it a career and calling. Thinks about their calling their entire time, is helping them. Because at 18, like I said before, they don't understand the life of work yet. And so we have to help ask the hard questions. And then my last one is, what if social capital was a higher education outcome? Because, you know, I work at a school that's 60% students of color. And I said, that's great. But if we graduate 50% of those students of color that go and work in management at McDonald's and Walmart and those types of things, and we never help them to develop the connections and the job opportunities and the jobs that will really change the economic course of their family's life, then we're doing them a disservice. We're indebting them to something that means that we're going to keep them right in the same place. So what if we saw, I just got through reading a book called Who You Know, and it's a very compelling case about how do we connect our students to larger networks? Because again, we see our role as these 4 years, but I think, no, we've got to see our role as these 10 years, right, and beyond. All right, I think that's all I have, but I wanted to give you my email address, and I'll be here to answer any questions, or do you have any questions before we go? Everyone's like, I got to get outside by the pool. Do not, you're looking around saying, if anyone asks a question, I'm going to kill them, okay? So, all right, thanks so much, and maybe I'll see some of you tomorrow.